Icon podcast. This week we are chewing over and analysing the results of Israel's second election this year. I'll be talking to Lahav Harkov from the Jerusalem Post and Raf Sanchez, the Daily Telegraph's correspondent in Israel. Richard Pater will be talking to Daphne Liel from Channel 2 News, and also Shalom Lipner, who was formerly a senior advisor in the Prime Minister's office working for Benjamin Netanyahu. Delighted now to be joined by Lahav Harkov, who is the senior contributing editor at the Jerusalem Post. Welcome, Lahav.
Thanks for having me.
So you are an avid follower of everything that's going on in Israeli politics. You've been imbibing all this for many years, and been watching obviously all the campaigns and their twists and turns of both elections. What did you take from the results that we've seen this week? What were the surprises that stood out for you?
I guess I've gotten so used to the surprise being that the Likud and the right does better than the polls predicted, that I was that's what I was expecting to be surprised by, if you
right.
expect to be surprised. And in the end, it didn't happen. In the end, Netanyahu did not pull a rabbit out of the hat, and we're at this impasse, and it's pretty much what the polls have been predicting all along. And I just thought, well, the polls are never that good, and I thought that the result would be something else.
Mm. I mean, that was a real surprise. I mean, I also the day before I said, right, I think there's going to be a late surge to the Kurd. I think we'll see a late surprise, and he'll edge it.
That's been the trend over the past few elections.
Well, why do you think that didn't happen? I mean, looking at the data, I mean, obviously it's early days, but it seems like there were a fair number of people who either voted for Likud, or you'd expect to vote for Likud because of other parties dropping out, that they just didn't show up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. First of all, I think that the sort of trick that Netanyahu pulled the last couple elections just didn't work this time. Israelis call it the Gewalt campaign, like Oy Gewalt, that Netanyahu panics at the end, or acts like he's panicking at the end of every election. And he says, we're losing. And he says, the Arabs are voting at very high numbers, and you all need to come out and you all need to vote Likud so we don't lose. And in doing that, he often took a lot of votes away from other right-wing parties. So this time he did manage to take votes away from other right-wing parties, it seems. But it wasn't enough, because basically everybody was doing the same thing. It was like comical to see so many politicians who were just out there acting as though, like, my career is about to be over. You all must come out. You all must vote. And the, voter turnout went up. Not a crazy amount, but although in the Israeli Arab public, voter turnout truly was high. Netanyahu was not just saying that, or maybe he was just saying that at the time, but it did end up being true. It went up about 11%. But in the general population, turnout was not lower. Everyone was expecting it to be lower. It was about 1% higher. But that trick to try to bring up turnout and to try to get all the whole right to just vote Likud, it's old now. Everybody knows it. It's become sort of like a national joke. Everyone calls it the Gewalt campaign. And so that's it. If Netanyahu will run in another election, he'll have to come up with something else. The other thing is, I think a significant amount of right-wing votes went to Yisrael Beiteinu and to Lieberman, and he is not a solid right-wing candidate this time, or was not a solid right-wing candidate this time, and we will have to wait and see what he does, but it seems more likely that he would pick blue and white. He would recommend Gantz. Because, why did he put us through this whole thing if he plans to make Netanyahu prime minister? Because Lieberman is, I would say, one of two kingmakers in this election, the other one being Ayman Oda.
Mm. I mean, that would be untenable, wouldn't it, if Lieberman, was offered some kind of creative rotating premiership and just decided to just go in with Likud and all the people like the ultra-Orthodox that he's been saying he wouldn't sit with for so long. I mean, that would be a step far too far, wouldn't it, for him? I mean, he would be betraying all these extra voters that voted for him, and also potentially his base.
Yeah, although I don't know. With Lieberman, he's not the most consistent. I mean, for a while, his slogan was like, my word is my bond, like as if he is the one politician who keeps his promises. But I think he's fairly inconsistent in a lot of ways. You know, his platform has always been more or less the same, but what he actually does has not always closely followed that platform. And, you know, just the fact that he's been like buddy-buddy with Haredi parties for years. Arya Derry was like one of his best friends. He supported Moshe Leon, which was the candidate that the Haredim supported for mayor of Jerusalem. And then suddenly he turns around now and he's this big fighter for secularism. So you see, he's not the most politically consistent person. And I don't think that he'll turn around and join a coalition with the Haredim right now, but if he did it, it wouldn't be totally out of character for him.
Yeah. I mean, the other story as well from the campaign was that maybe, you know, on the right of the Likud, people expected that Yamina party under Ayelet Shaked would perform better. But they, you know, if you count the votes of, you know, what was the new right in April under Naftali Bennett and then United Right under Rafi Peretz, I mean, they underperformed, didn't they? I mean, is there a reason for that, do you think?
Yeah, I think they significantly underperformed. And, you know, I think maybe Fennin and Shaked, to some extent, really should be in Likud. And they're only not in Likud because Netanyahu can't stand them.
Yeah.
And so people who are going to vote for the new right, maybe not all of them, but I think a lot of them, would have just gone back to Likud or even Lieberman because they were voting for new right because they were looking for a very right-wing party on diplomatic issues that's a little bit more socially liberal. They're not looking for, liberal might be pushing it, but is not a religious party, you know, is not so socially conservative the way the other parties in Yamina are. And so, you know, if for that position, you have the Likud or, you know, you have Yisrael Beiteinu, which takes it to a totally secularist direction, which is not what the new right represented, but maybe some people would have preferred that. And I think that by joining Beit UD again, Bennett and Shaked sort of lost what was unique about them as candidates.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the bigger picture in terms of what's happening on the sort of ideological map, I mean, you know, I can't help but think, you know, if Lieberman would have just, you know, gone him in the government in April, then obviously there wouldn't have been an election. We'd be talking about the fact that there's, you know, yet another right-wing, ultra-Orthodox majority coalition. So nothing's really changed, has it, on the ideological map? I mean, you know, there's a few things we can point to, like, you know, the extreme right, they didn't make it in. That tells us something. On the centre-left, you know, Labour still where it was. Merit maybe improved slightly with Ehud Barak and Sthav Shafir. But do you see that there's been any sort of change in that map at all? Are we still frozen where we were?
I do think we're pretty much frozen where we were. I don't think there's a big change. I think that any change came from the significant increase in turnout among Israeli Arabs. The joint list has two more seats than it did before. You know, they didn't run as a joint list last time. They ran as two separate blocks, but it's the combined seats. I don't see a significant shift. The difference, it's not that people moved from right to left. It's that Lieberman took his votes, took his seats, and said, I'm not going to commit them here or there.
Yeah.
So you could say that some of those people might have been people who had wanted Netanyahu to be prime minister earlier in the year, but maybe not. I mean, it's not data that we have. There's no way for us to really know. But anyone who votes for Lieberman has to be somewhat right-wing. I mean, he has a very right-wing platform, except for the secular part. So when you look at it policy-wise or ideology-wise, it's not that Israelis have changed so much. It's that the political game has changed a bit.
And looking at like Labour Gesher and this new Democratic Union, I mean, were they just at the limits of where they could get to, or do you think that they ran a bad campaign, or was it, you know, particularly Labour's point that blue and white just kind of ate them up because that's where the momentum was?
I think that ever since Ehud Olmert resigned as prime minister. So we're going back, I think, 12 years, 10 years, 12 years. The political field has sort of organized itself into the BB camp on the right and then the not BB camp in the center and the left. And then whoever is seen as the leading candidate who could be prime minister instead of Netanyahu becomes the leader of that camp. So we had Kadima, and then we had Yesh Atid, and then we had Labor, and now we have Blue and White. And whoever is seen as the strategic vote to topple Netanyahu will dominate that camp. And Labor has not been able to appear as the party that will replace Netanyahu since 2015. And even after that election, it lost its luster very, very quickly because then Labor leader Isaac Herzog negotiated to join Netanyahu's coalition. He didn't do it in the end, but it was people knew that that's what he was doing, and it was reported in the media. So they very quickly stopped being seen as the hope to replace Netanyahu. I think they have a chance of a comeback, but I do think that in the current political climate, being a centrist party is a stronger position than being a left-wing party.
Yeah. And so I guess the big question now is, I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, we've seen, you know, on Thursday, Bibi Netanyahu saying he's going to call in Gantz, talk about unity. Did you see that's just another ploy? Is that serious? Can he feel that maybe the momentum's shifting from him now that Blue and White are two seats ahead?
Everybody sort of dismissed it as just a ploy. I think Netanyahu is hedging his bets.
Right.
I think maybe Netanyahu hopes not to have to do that, but he's going to keep the chance open. Because the bottom line is Netanyahu wants to be prime minister for the coming at least couple of years. And so he'll do what it takes to be prime minister. And if it requires him to not be with his right-wing partners in a coalition in the end, I think he would do that too. I think he'll politically do almost anything in order to be prime minister. And so I think maybe right now it's like a strategic offer so that when Gantz says no to him, then Netanyahu can be like, Gantz wants there to be a third election. You know, he doesn't really want there to be a government. But I still think that he would do it if Gantz said yes.
Yeah. And then that would have to be a situation. I mean, the only thing that Netanyahu would accept would be Gantz accepting a lesser position. I mean, he's not going to maybe accept a rotating prime minister.
So what's interesting and what happened really about an hour before you called me is that Netanyahu and Gantz were both at a memorial service for Shimon Peres. It's his yard site. And Netanyahu said to Gantz, let's cooperate like Shamir and Peres did. And Shamir and Peres had a rotation government between 1984 and 1988. The first 2 years was Peres. The next 2 years were Shamir. So Netanyahu is at least saying he's willing to do a rotation. And again, I think Netanyahu would much rather not have a rotation if he can manage. But I also think that if Gantz says yes, then Netanyahu would go through with it because, you know, he wants to stay prime minister. And if Netanyahu can be first, it would not only help him in his legal situation because he's coming from a much stronger position if he's prime minister, but there's also always the chance that he could just call an election before it's actually Gantz's turn.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trick, isn't it, with rotating prime minister arrangements, is that there is that danger. And then also, even if you do stick to it, the handover is very complicated. And the person who's prime minister also lasts can sometimes get a big incumbency advantage if they're the prime minister going into that election. So it's fascinating.
That's what happened in 1988, is that Shamir then became prime minister again. Yeah. And that's the only rotation between prime ministers in Israel's history. I think it sort of feels like Shamir and Peres were in a rotation throughout the entire 1980s, but that was only because of the electorate and not because of an agreement.
I mean, one thing I was going to ask is, we talked a lot before this election about Bibi Netanyahu needing 61 members of Knesset to grant him immunity from prosecution, and he hasn't got a 61-seat majority. Even if he pulled together something with Gantz, I mean, do you see a situation where the one condition Bibi would have was that they vote to give him immunity, or do you think the Blue and White would say, no, we're just not going to do that, and they'll stick to their guns? How do you feel about that?
The truth is that for Blue and White to join a coalition with Netanyahu, they would lose a lot of their credibility, and I don't think Lapid would do it. I don't think Lapid would do it under almost any circumstances. I think maybe Gantz would. But the immunity, look, never say never, but I don't really see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, because the one thing I thought from the results overnight was that when Bibi Netanyahu did not have an easy 61-seat majority, then he's not going to get that immunity vote. He's on his way to a, you know, this you know, to the hearing and to potentially a criminal trial unless he has a plea bargain. He's not going to get that vote now, is what I thought. But you're saying, I suppose, never say never.
Right.
Yeah. No, that makes
I mean,
sense.
Just, you know, Israel never had two elections in one year before either, and we just had it now. We never had someone tasked with being prime minister who wasn't able to form a coalition. I think we haven't had it in a very long time.
One thing I wanted to ask is about Likud, and I think people will be watching very carefully around the movement and who's speaking to who among key people like Yuli Edelstein, Gideon Saar, others. Like, what are the signs that we need to be looking for, if there are ever going to be any, that there's discomfort among some of those senior people in Likud and they might want to try and see if they can ease Bibi Netanyahu out the door? What do you think we should be looking for?
For the most part, you won't see any of those signs until there's a total failure on Netanyahu's part. So, you know, look out for it in a couple months from now, maybe. The one thing, maybe, is that before the election, Nir Barkat, the former mayor of Jerusalem, who did not run for re-election last year in order so he could run in the Likud, and he has a very high position on the Likud list. He expressed some discomfort with the tenor of Netanyahu's campaign. That, you know, especially Netanyahu sort of making comments that could be seen as delegitimizing Israeli Arabs.
Mm.
It was a very subtle, I would say, expression of discomfort. And it was in response to a question. He didn't like volunteer this information. But that was the only thing I saw. And I think that if that had gotten a lot of media play, then, you know, the party would have come out against Barkat. Mm. You know, the knives are out anyway. There's so many people who think that they should be the next leader of Likud that, like, the minute any of them makes a misstep, and at this point, criticizing Netanyahu will be seen as a misstep, the others will all pounce.
So we're still in the phase where everyone has to swear blind loyalty, and anyone who doesn't will be edged out as a potential leader. So it's that sense no one wants to be the one to actually pull the knife.
At this point, yeah. I think that, you know, until we see that there's a total sort of failure of Netanyahu to form a government, or if we get an indictment, like, really quickly after Netanyahu's hearing in the beginning of October, then it's not going to happen. But I don't think what people are saying is that the indictment won't happen so fast. It's not going to be the next week. So I don't think that would come first.
Yeah, I mean, we should remind our listeners, I mean, that there's supposed to be a hearing, isn't there, in the first week of October. And that's an opportunity for Bibi to present his evidence. And then you'd expect the Attorney General to make a decision within maybe a month.
He works very slowly.
Yeah.
I don't have a prediction, but if he does it within a month, even that would be surprising to me.
Right. And then that is his final decision to indict, and that goes towards that then heads to a trial, and that's where it gets really serious, which is why the timing is so awful for Bibi in terms of the hearing decision and then the coalition formation. Okay. I mean, that's been fascinating, Lahav. Thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you who don't, do follow Lahav on Twitter. She's prolific in terms of analyzing Israeli politics, so don't miss out on that one. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, our next guest is Raf Sanchez, who is the Israel correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. And he's actually been covering Israel for nearly 4 years. So welcome to the podcast, Raf.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. One of the things I wanted to really ask you is that you've had this intense experience of, on the one hand, there not being anything big happening in terms of elections for a while on your beat, and then all of a sudden you get these two consecutive election campaigns coming thick and fast after each other. I just wanted to get a sense from you, like, what's it been like to cover such an intensive period of campaigning that's pretty much been coming up to almost sort of 10 months in a row?
Right. It's kind of like London buses, right? You wait for years for one and then two all at once. It has been very intense. We've gone from kind of 0 to 60 in terms of Israeli politics. That, you know, until sort of the end of 2018, everything was very stable and calm for a while. And then when Avigdor Lieberman stormed out of the government in November, accusing Netanyahu of weakness over Hamas, it's pretty much just been chaos since, with elections almost being called and then being aborted. And then we finally having one in April, and it looking like Netanyahu had won. And then that victory kind of turning to ashes in his mouth. And sort of here we go again with a second election in September. Israeli elections are interesting. You know, you just got to remind yourself how small Israel is, right? It's a physically small country. You know, it's 9 million people. And so during election time, you really kind of, you almost can't move without bumping into something. You know, you can be walking along Jaffa Street in Jerusalem, and Gabi Ashkenazi from Kahol Levan is marching down the street, and he's got people behind him. Or you're in some shopping mall in Bat Yam, and Avigdor Lieberman is there talking to Russian voters. So, you know, if American elections are kind of these, you know, big, the campaigns are almost essentially White Houses, right? The candidate is inside this big bubble and they only speak in these massive stadium rallies. British elections are a little bit more intimate, but they're still fairly staged, managed. You know, Israeli elections, really, you're up close and personal all the time. What's interesting is they, even during elections, when politicians in theory should care only about people, Israeli politicians should care only about people who are citizens who actually get to vote, they still care what's in the foreign press about them. And partly because Israeli politicians care more about the foreign press, I think, than politicians in the UK and the US do. But it's partly actually because what they call here the Anglo vote, so the vote of Israeli citizens who are originally from the UK or more likely from the US, is worth a couple of seats. And so everybody does a fair bit of campaigning in English. Gantz did a big event in English in Tel Aviv. Netanyahu puts out quite a lot of English videos. And it's because the English-speaking vote matters in the same way that the Russian-speaking vote matters. So you actually hear Israeli politicians campaigning in English and in Russian as well as in Hebrew.
It's a curious mix, isn't it, Israeli politics? And you mentioned there about, you know, people popping up on streets and just doing these impromptu gatherings. I mean, it's almost like sort of the 19th century in Britain, where you sort of had these moments where like politicians would pop up and do these stump speeches and kind of, you know, go from place to place. But at the same time, you've got this incredibly high tech element of the election campaign, where all the parties are competing to produce these very witty, very sharp campaign videos, and then as soon as they've been produced, then, you know, the other party produces one that takes the mickey out of the previous one. It's a bizarre mixture, isn't it, of the kind of the new and the old. Did you get that sense?
Yeah, totally. Facebook is massive here. You know, targeted advertising on Facebook and also Facebook Lives. Netanyahu pretty much spent all of Election Day doing Facebook Live videos, in some ways quite low tech. He'd be on his iPhone on speaker, speaking to some Likudnik living in Efrat or something, and then he would just sort of broadcast his conversation on Facebook Live, which is why on election night his voice was totally hoarse and giving out. Right. He's been speaking all day. So yeah, it is that the ads are interesting too. Israeli politics can be quite macho, you know, and everybody's talking about their military credentials, and both Gantz and Netanyahu are talking about all the commando missions they did in Syria when they were younger and stuff. But then the advertising is actually it can be quite sort of self-deprecating and low-key compared to the sort of Hollywood-style ads you see in American presidential elections and these big cinematic numbers you see in the party political broadcasts in the UK. There's one ad where Bibi, this is from a couple of elections ago, but Netanyahu shows up at the door of the Israeli couple who's going out for a date. And they're leaving.
I remember this one.
And he presents himself as the babysitter who's there to look after their kid, which, you know, given that this guy has his finger on the nuclear trigger, it was quite, I don't know, it was quite sort of low key and endearing.
Yeah. In terms of how the politicians have evolved during the campaign, I mean, there's certainly, obviously we're a bit far from removed from it over in London, but I mean, there's definitely a sense on two sides that, you know, did Gantz grow into this second campaign a little bit more? I mean, the first one, he was a little bit rough around the edges. He was very new to it. Did this second election give him that opportunity to come across as a bit more polished? And do you think that in some ways, I mean, you know, that the kind of Bibi's hoarse voice at the end seemed to be a bit of a metaphor for the fact that not only did he sort of exhaust himself, but did he also sort of overreach in terms of all these frantic last minute promises? So there's kind of two questions there. Thoughts about Gantz and growing into the role, and whether you think the story about Bibi and how he campaigned was a question of just too many promises and overreaching.
I'm not sure how much Gantz necessarily grew into the role, but he right. definitely was more cautious in this election. He did fewer media appearances. He just didn't say as much as he did last time. Right. And that may partly be that just nobody knew who he was really in April. And so he had to do a lot to introduce himself to the public, and people were a bit more familiar with him in September. But I suspect also it was sort of a new strategy that they felt that actually, when he doesn't say anything, he looks sort of commanding and statesmanlike mm-hmm. and like the former general that he is. And that actually, when he talks too much, he often kind of does sooner or later trip over his words and say something that becomes an issue. So I think we didn't see as much of him this time around. And, you know, it seems to have worked as these things go. In terms of Netanyahu, he has just been completely frenetic all out months. And actually, even in this post-election period, you're kind of seeing that same dynamic that Gantz is slow and steady and statesmanlike, and Bibi is moving at a gazillion miles an hour, trying to move the pieces around the board all the time. And I think there was a sense that two things. One, that Netanyahu's habit of telling voters that he's about to lose, right-wing voters that he's about to lose, and that if they don't turn out, they're going to cost him the election. It may just be that he's sort of the boy who cried wolf, that voters have just heard it so many times, and they heard it most recently a couple months ago, and it just didn't have the same effects in September that it did in April. And also, it just felt like ahead of the last election, Netanyahu managed to pull a whole lot of tricks out of his hat between going to the White House and getting Trump to sign, you know, to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And then he went to Russia and he got Putin to help him return the bodies of two Israeli soldiers killed in Lebanon in the 80s.
Yeah.
And this time he was trying to do the same thing and none of them really worked. He dashed to London a week before the election to meet the American Defense Secretary. And the expectation was he was going to come away with a piece of paper where the U.S. would commit itself to Israel's defense going forward. And he came back empty-handed. Nothing really happened at that meeting. And similarly, he went to Russia right before the election, 4 days before the election, and didn't really come back with anything. And he made this big promise to annex the Jordan Valley. But I think a lot of Israeli voters, including on the right, kind of shrugged and saw that as a fairly transparent election gimmick and weren't that convinced that it was something he would actually do.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely how a lot of people are reading it. And the interesting story that we were analyzing about the results of the election is really in the sense that they could sort of really lost. I mean, they had 35 seats in April. They joined with the Kulanu party that was worth 4 seats in April. You know, you would have expected them to be, you know, in the high 30s. And instead, it looks like they've only got 31, which is a quite a significant number of former Likud voters who either went somewhere else or just stayed at home, as you say. And this point about saying that everyone's staying at home, you know, people just didn't believe it, or they just were turned off by whatever's happening in that campaign. Is that how you interpreted it as well?
Yeah, I haven't yet seen the raw numbers on number of votes. It's clear that, one, just fewer people voted Likud last time than they did before, which is obviously just a massive step one problem if you're a political party. Yeah. And then the other thing is that the Arab voters turned out at much larger numbers this time than they did April. It looks like there was about a 50% turnout in April, and it seems to be a little over 60 this time. And that just has the effect of, you know, more votes for the Arab Party means fewer votes for everybody else. And interestingly, you know, I'd say a big part of the reason that the Arab voters turned out in larger numbers this time, partly because the joint list, the kind of joint, like the coalition of Arab parties, got the hands back together in September, whereas in April they'd run as separate, bunch of separate parties. But a big part of the reason I think the Arab vote was up is that Netanyahu just talked about them and incited against them so much in the run-up to the election, proposing this law to put cameras in polling stations that was clearly aimed at Arab voters, constantly warning that the Arabs were going to take over the government. And interestingly, Miki Zohar, who is one of Bibi's most slavishly loyal Likud MKs, popped up the day after the election and said, yeah, that actually does seem to have backfired. We seem to have really activated the Arab voter base this time, which was kind of a disaster for us.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose the big question is, you know, on Thursday, it looked like Bibi Netanyahu, who's reached out to Benny Gantz, he said, let's talk about a national unity government. And this picture of them with President Rivlin at the Shimon Peres Memorial is the kind of big picture of the week, in a way, in terms of post-election. I mean, you know, I'll ask you the big question. I know it's a difficult one, but, you know, what do you think is going to happen now? I mean, how do you see this playing out?
So my sense is that we're still totally in maneuvering rather than actually negotiating stage. I think, like I said, Netanyahu is the one doing all the hustling. So immediately after the election, he got together with all the right-wing parties, and they've signed this document now where they say that they will only go into coalition all together. So, you know, they have literally signed a document. So assuming Netanyahu isn't tearing up a document that his party signs, you know, a couple of hours ago, when Netanyahu says, let's go into coalition, Benny Gantz, he's actually saying blue and white should give me the numbers to get to a majority on top of my coalition of right-wing parties, which isn't really much of a unity government. That's basically all the right-wing parties plus Benny Gantz to make up the numbers. So right. I don't really see that as a genuine offer. I see that more as Netanyahu trying to set the table for negotiations. I think big picture in terms of what's going to happen, Gantz says he wants Netanyahu to resign and then he wants a unity government with Likud. Netanyahu says he's not going anywhere, and Likud say they're sticking by him. I do think clearly the walls are closing in on Netanyahu. He has these corruption hearings coming up in October, and he potentially has restless Likud ministers who are ready for him to go anyway. One of my favorite statistics in Israeli politics is that Likud has only had four leaders since 1973. And Bibi has been the leader for 20 years in two stints. So if you're one of the top Likud ministers, you've been waiting a really long time for a chance to become the leader. So are you going to continue staying loyal to this guy who has failed to win the most seats, who has a corruption hearing coming up in a few weeks? That's one of the big questions.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing statistic. And also, I mean, it's something that Angel Pfeffer, the Bibi biographer, always mentions. And the second point as well is that no Likud leader or any leader of the revisionist Zionist movement has ever been forced out. I mean, Jabotinsky died, Begin resigned, Shamir resigned, and Ariel Sharon switched parties. So there's no precedent whatsoever for any kind of maneuvering or sort of palace coup to topple a leader and force them out. It's literally not in their DNA. So fascinating.
Yeah, totally. I spoke to Nir Barkat, the former mayor of Jerusalem and the Likud MK now, on election night. And he said exactly that. It's just not in our DNA and the Likud turn against their leader, especially in difficult times. I think when you're looking at it from the perspective of British politics, where in the Conservative Party anyway, we're used to the men in the gray suits showing up at prime minister's offices and with the whiskey and the revolver and telling them, it just doesn't happen like that inside the Likud. Interestingly, the Labour Party is much more happy to stab its leaders in the back, it seems. But it doesn't mean it won't happen, right? Sooner or later, something has to give. And you know, one possibility is that the Give is on Likud's side and they do get rid of Netanyahu and then they're able to go into meet Benny Gantz's demands and go into coalition. But the other side is that Gantz, you know, under pressure to form this unity government, under pressure not to be seen as the one who's blocking the unity government and sending the country to a third election, eventually gives and decides to, you know, enter into some power sharing agreement with Netanyahu, possibly calculating that Netanyahu doesn't have that long anyway, that he'll be driven out by the corruption stuff at some point. And so you could agree to share power with him now, and he'll probably have to slink off on his own at some point in a couple of months. It's very hard to say, but clearly for Netanyahu, it's existential, right? If Netanyahu compromises on this, his whole career is over. If Gantz compromises, you know, he's going to have a lot of very angry voters, but there's potentially a way forward. So,
yeah, very interesting. Raf Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us. And for listeners, it's worth following Raf on Twitter. He's a prolific writer of the latest developments in Israel. He also has regular articles in the Telegraph, and also an excellent letter that he does from Israel around a collection of the latest stories, which is also worth subscribing to. But thank you so much for joining us and being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
This is Richard Pater, the director of BICOM's Israel office. I'm delighted to be joined on the line with Daphna Liel, the political correspondent from Channel 12 News. Daphna, thank you very much indeed for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for hosting me, Richard.
I wanted just to clarify, this is Wednesday afternoon, and we have all the votes have been counted, but we don't yet have the official confirmation of the results. So everything we say is with a caveat that anything may well change. Looking ahead, I mean, what it looks like the results are that neither left wing or right wing bloc really get over the magic number of 61 itself. So the first thing I'd like to ask you, how do you rate the chances of forming a national unity government?
There's quite high chances right now. As you said, we are in a very complex situation. It's a huge political headache for the Israeli politics. No one has enough fingers in the parliament to form a coalition, and they can't live one without the other. That's the situation right now. So the obvious situation is to form a coalition together. The problem is that the leader of Blue and White, Gantz, said and repeated it again and again that he won't form a coalition with Netanyahu because of his investigations. And he has a record of a very honest person. He's new in politics. He's not one of those politicians that no one takes seriously. He will have to pay a very high price to break his own word, considering forming a coalition with Netanyahu. On the other hand, Netanyahu also said that he doesn't want to sit with the left. He doesn't want to cooperate with them. And he has a problem that the left wing side of the politics in Israel won't help him get out of his investigations. And this is a huge headache for Netanyahu, because if he will form a coalition with the left, center, blue, right, and the other parties, he will his clock will start ticking, because his indictment is getting closer and closer, and he had this dream that the right wing will help him form a new law or give him immunity in the Knesset, and this is obviously not going to happen. So both sides have a lot to lose from cooperating, but they might have no chance but to go together.
Thank you. I mean, if we're in a situation where even after the process, after the 28 days and even extension, that we're basically at a deadlock, and we're looking at I shouldn't even say it, but a third election, unless there is another leader of the Likud that would go into the government, is there any chance you think that the Likud would replace Netanyahu in that scenario and go into a national unity government?
Right now, the right is united behind Netanyahu. They're going with him. They're giving him the credit. They're giving him a chance to try to form a government with or without blue and white, without the left wing. But if he will fail, It's definitely an option that they will try to replace him. It's not easy, especially not in the right wing, that they're very united behind the leader. But this is an option that exists. No one wants to go into third elections, not in the left wing side, not in the right. No one wants it. It's very unlikely. And I think that Benny Gantz will prefer to sit with Netanyahu and break his own word than going to a third election, because the one that will be blamed for the third election will pay a very high price in the next round, and I think everyone will do their best to prevent it.
Thank you. I know we're in the realm of theoretical speculation, but in that scenario, the head of the largest party outside of the governing coalition would be the joint list and led by Ayman Oda. Can you see a scenario where he would become leader of the opposition?
Sure, it's an option. It depends on who will be the other members of the opposition, because according to the Israeli law, the biggest the head of the biggest list is supposed to be the head of the opposition. Unless all the other parties or most of them want someone else. And if we will see an opposition that has on one side the Arabs, but on the other side the Haredim and maybe the right-wing parties that are not going, will not go with Netanyahu to a united government, they might decide on someone else from, for example, the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox parties. So it's still not something that we can say right now. It depends on the final results and who will be in the opposition, who will be in the coalition.
And just finally, I mean, what do you think is likely, if we stand here now on the 18th of September, what do you think is the most likely scenario of the government, the shape of the next government?
I am ashamed to say that I really don't know. We didn't see this coming, let's put it this way. But the most likely government is a government that has blue and white on one side and the Likud on the other side, with other parties, for example, Lieberman's party, or maybe another party from the right or the left or both. But this will be the main part of it, the united government. The question is who will be the Likud's leader in this case. Will it be Netanyahu or will it be someone else? And who will be first? This is dramatic considering Netanyahu's legal situation, because he wants to enter his legal sentence, if he would be indicted, or this whole process, when he's still in power, when he's still the Prime Minister of Israel. And that's why he won't in any chance agree to be second, unless he will have no other way at all to stay in the political arena. It will be very, very interesting to see what will happen in the Likud side. In blue and white, it's much clearer. There is one leader and everyone is united behind him.
That's incredibly useful. Daphna, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Richard Pater, and I'm delighted to be joined today with Shalom Lipner, who has a wealth of experience at the Prime Minister's office, I think over 25 years there, and now is a senior visiting fellow at the Atlantic Council. Shalom, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
I'm glad to be with you, Richard.
So if I can start and just ask you, I mean, over the last 24 hours, we're still waiting for the formal results of the election, but over the last 24 hours, Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday kind of tried to seal up his right-wing base and kind of have the other right-wing parties guaranteed to be locked in with him. And then this morning, a kind of a contradictory statement of offering Benny Gantz, reaching out for a broad unity government. With your experience from the Prime Minister's office, what do you think is on the Prime Minister's mind? What's his top strategy here?
I think right now, indeed, as you said, the final results aren't in yet. But I think if one thing is clear, it's that, you know, Netanyahu may be down, but he's certainly not out. And what he's trying to do, exactly as you said right now, is sort of consolidate his forces for the next battle. That will inevitably require him bringing all the people that he's tried to bring on board. And what he's done is trying to consolidate them into a block that will negotiate with whoever on the other side as one unit. And be able to bring them all to the table. More importantly, to sort of position them as a block against the other side, to suggest that if you don't work with me, then there's no possibility of any other government being formed right now. So I think in the next, in the coming weeks, we'll be able to see right now what emerges on the other end. I mean, right now we're in the stage of, I think, of advanced horse trading with no clear path to majority for either the left or the right. And it will require also to see the final results and also to see what kind of outcome there is from this sort of dance back and forth as each side tries to call the other's bluff and, if nothing else, sort of set them up as who would be conceivably as the guilty party for if the negotiations fail and the country falls into a third election even.
What do you think? What would you say is the Prime Minister's priority right now?
Priority in what sense?
Priority to get himself over the 61. Where do you think he is kind of his preferred option is to go?
Well, I mean, as you suggest, I mean, certainly for him, I mean, like I said earlier about down and not out, I think that this is shaping up to sort of be his last hurrah. He's facing personal and political challenges down the pike immediately, almost in the immediate term, with the hearing in front of the Attorney General. And I think that, his overarching concern right now is to be able to sort of form a government that allows him to address these challenges from a position of power. As I said, right now there are no obvious choices in terms of what kind of government he can put together. Conventional wisdom seems to suggest that the only viable path right now is some sort of coalition government with the other side, a national unity government, as they call them over here. But what that will require on all sides is that the protagonists will have to make a decision. I mean, the preconditions that they put on the table during the campaign would actually prevent them all from working out any solution, because they don't all add up into sort of one fitted solution. So I mean, what will have to happen is that as a result of this arm wrestle, one side or the other will have to sort of mitigate or concede the promises they made earlier in favor of being able to sit together with the other side. I think that the Prime Minister's made his demands, and he's sort of rallied his troops to stand behind him as the only candidate that the right wing will field and the person who would have to be the Prime Minister in that sort of solution. So I mean, that's the demand he will make of Gantz, who has said that we're not willing to sign on for an agreement with Likud that sustains Netanyahu himself as the Prime Minister. So I mean, what we're going to be watching for right now is whether or not the parties are willing to sort of show flexibility in their original promises, or whether they won't, which again will conceivably spiral downward into another campaign.
Behind the scenes in the Likud, do you sense there is a move of anyone else to, if he was a bit unsuccessful, to kind of to make that deal with Blue and White?
Well, we've not seen it yet. The sense is that there is division within the ranks, that for various factors in terms of the relationship that Netanyahu himself has cultivated with his ministers, there's more than a little dissatisfaction. As I mentioned sort of facetiously, I think the sound that we hear is of their long knives being unsheathed right now. I don't think we're going to see them in play immediately. Again, final results have to be tallied. More importantly, the culture within the Likud is not forgiving to challengers to the incumbent. So I don't think we're going to see anything that happens immediately. I think they'll be waiting for results or for some sort of to see how the hearings with the Attorney General proceed, to see if the Prime Minister is moving in the direction of sort of extracting himself from his legal problems, or whether he's sinking deeper into that morass. And then based on the calculations that they make about whether or not there's a sort of substantial basis to get up and to say it's time to move on, depending on how strident, say, Blue and White and under Benny Gantz is in their condition that they will not be willing to sign the agreement with Likud, who they would like to sign with, unless Netanyahu has moved aside. And as pressure increases for people to say we definitely, Israelis definitely do not want a third campaign, then conceivably there could be sort of louder dissent within the ranks of people saying, well, if we would only move Netanyahu aside, we could have a government tomorrow, and that could create some sort of groundswell of a movement in that direction. But as I said, I think it's still a little early for that.
Thank you very much, Shalom.
Pleasure.